no shock here, but I was obsessed with books even as a kid, and my favorites were those by A.A. Milne about a very special bear, Winnie the Pooh. As an adult, I became obsessed with the place where Pooh, Christopher Robin, and their friends live and play. The Hundred Acre Wood, the setting for Winnie the Pooh's adventures, was inspired by Ashdown Forest, a wildlife haven that spans more than 6,000 miles in southeast England. I went trekking through the forest last December, one of the most meaningful adventures I've ever been on. So when I first learned of Catherine Alto's new book, The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, I felt like it was written just for me. In the pages of the book, you can visit the ancient black walnut tree on the edge of the forest that became Pooh's house, go deep into the pine trees to find Pooh Stick's bridge, and climb up to the top of the enchanted galleon's lap where Pooh says goodbye to Christopher Robin. You will discover how Milne's childhood connection with nature and his role as a father influenced his famous stories, and how his close collaboration with illustrator Ernest Shepherd brought those stories to life. Catherine Alto is an American landscape designer, historian, writer, and lecturer living in Exeter, England. She has master's degrees in garden history and creative nonfiction, with a particular interest in literary landscapes. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Catherine Alto to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you.
What brought you to want to do this?
There's a long answer to that. I taught American Literature of Nature and Place for many years in the Pacific Northwest before I flew to England in 2007. My husband's a professor at the University of Exeter. So that's what took us to Devon, England. And so I've always had an interest in the intersection between nature and culture and literary landscapes. So when we moved there, we have three children. They were 3, 6, and 9 at the time. And we kind of left behind their own 100-acre wood. We have a 20-acre beautiful farm outside of Seattle with meadows and woods and a salmon spawning stream and, you know, lots of wildlife. And I was sort of trying to figure out how to live in this new country that was like a storybook landscape. But I as a Western American, I just could barely relate to the quilted hedgerow landscape below me. So within the first week of moving there, I just stumbled across a book on walking in England. And before my jet lag wore off, actually, we had clocked in about 20 miles of walking, and I was hooked after that. And at the same time, I was reading the classic Winnie the Pooh stories to comfort my children. And just, you know, they're just such classics that it was a way to keep them grounded. And one thing led to another, and I was curious. Could we actually walk in this 100-acre wood? Was it a real place? And one thing led to another, and there you have the book.
Two things that struck me upon visiting Ashdown Forest, and I would like to explore both of them with you in some detail. One of them is that it is relatively unscathed in the sense that while there is an occasional marker, there is a memorial, there is a plaque, and that's about it. And it also isn't very easy to find out information as to what is there and where you're going and if you're going the right place. And I assume that is all intentional.
Yeah. Well, the area is one step down to our version of like a national park. It's in an area called an area of outstanding natural beauty. It's called an AONB. So it's a protected place. And then Ashdown Forest itself, if you can imagine like all the security around the Tower of London, the crown jewels of the Tower of London, it has almost as many environmental protections surrounding the forest. So that the conservation of this rare heathland there and the woodlands actually in turn preserves the literary landscape that we know. So, I mean, I'm sure you experience this. You walk on Jill's lap, which is Galleon's lap in the story, and you see the gorse and the heathland and the Scots pines, and you really feel like you are walking through an E.H. Shepherd illustration. It's really electrifying, and it's beautiful. So it's the protection of the environment that actually protects the literary landscape. People cannot do certain things in the area. And as such, you're right. There's one sign that says Path to Pooh Bridge. There's, in the lovely village of Hartfield, there's a little shop called Pooh's Corner. And but other than that, it's very English and very understated. There's nothing exploited in the landscape at all. And you probably know that you could just disappear into the landscape and walk for half a day without seeing anybody. So there's a real wildness to it as well.
The other thing that you come away with, or at least I did, especially in spending so much time there, is that, and I guess this surprised me just because of nature, because of what nature is, but you see the things that are part of the illustrations. You see what Pooh saw. You see what Christopher Robin saw. You see what these characters, Piglet and Tigger and Roo, what they experienced. And the fact that you can have that moment in a real landscape from something that was on several pages and a book published, you know, nearly 100 years ago is really incredible.
It is really incredible. The English are very proud of that. When I first started writing the book, I was a bit self-conscious that I'm this, you know, tall American, and I would work in, you know, 15th century pubs with papers strewn out everywhere on the wooden tables, and the sun would come out and I'd dash away and come back, and people were kind of curious what was she doing. I was a bit reticent to say what I was doing initially because I didn't want them to feel like I was exploiting this A.A. Milne connection, and this Winnie the Pooh connection to this landscape. I really sort of kept it on the down low for a while. But after I talked to people, they thought the project was fabulous. I was embraced by villagers. They're really proud of that part of their English heritage, and you can feel it. It's very low key and protected. It's lovely.
Of course, A.A. Milne lived in London, and his son, Christopher Robin, lived there too, but this was their country house.
It was their country house. They lived, Cotchford Farm was where they lived. It's on the edge of the forest. They bought the place in 1925 and visited it on long weekends and holidays and in the summer. But then they moved down there permanently a few years later, and Christopher Robin had a wonderful childhood. And they did that because A.A. Milne and his wife Daphne wanted to give Christopher Robin a magical childhood like A.A. Milne had. And Daphne grew up surrounded by beautiful gardens and landscapes as well. But they wanted to give that to their son, and that's where the stories originated. Actually, the very first Winnie the Pooh story originated from A.A. Milne watching Christopher Robin playing in a crevice in an ancient walnut tree. It was about 300 years old. It actually fell down in the 1970s. But Christopher Robin would play there with his animals, and he would go for long walks, and he was able to wander around. So the books are based on Milne's reflections of his own amazing, quite extraordinary childhood in a landscape, you know, through English meadows and so forth, watching his own son play, and then using, you know, his own writerly imagination to make the stories come alive.
The name of the book is The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, a walk through the forest that inspired the 100-acre wood. Our guest is Catherine Alto. When you look at, as I mentioned, that close connection between walking through the forest and what we remember in reading the books and what we see when we read the books today, has a lot to do with the very close relationship between A.A. Milne and E.H. Shepherd, who was the illustrator, and the two worked very, very closely together, which you point out in the book.
They worked together at Punch magazine, which is a satire magazine, very well-known satire magazine in London. They collaborated really well together. It wasn't as if there was, an agent involved who took the stories to an unknown illustrator. I had the great privilege of reading letters between the two men, and at one point, A.A. Milne wanted there to be the iconic 100-acre wood map didn't have doors in the trees, for example, and he thought, no, it needs. If you could add trees, doors to the trees, there'd be a little bit more charm to that. So the doors were added to the trees. In one story, in which Owl's house blows down, I read a wonderful letter in which Milne described in detail how he wanted the mailbox to be upside down, and he wanted Piglet, to scamper up and through the mailbox. So there was a lot of back and forth. They were great collaborators, and I'd say that one reason why the stories are endure as classics for so long and resonate through so many generations of people is that Milne and Shepherd were kind of like the Lennon and McCartney of their era. They wrote their pitch-perfect books. They were both young fathers. I wouldn't say young, in their 40s, late 30s and 40s. They both had boys around the same age. They were both sensitive in different ways. A.A. Milne had a glorious golden childhood of just sort of aimless wandering and so forth. And E.H. Shepherd lost his mother when he was 11 years old, and he wrote in his autobiography that it took years and years to sort of regain this happiness. And he was a child, an artistic child, whose tendencies were cultivated by his artistic mother. So he missed her a lot, and yet she had cultivated these talents in him, and he continued to use that great emotional sensitivity caused by his mother's death, but also his talent. And so when you see Shepherd illustrating Piglet reaching up to hold Pooh's paw, or you see the tilt of Pooh's chin towards something, or the sense of uncertainty in the characters, you can just see that these two men together were absolutely perfect. And the illustrations were not colored until, I think, the 60s, I believe. So people were reacting to the simple, you know, black and white sketches and the stories. It was very sort of elemental. There was no Disney at the time, and there wasn't, you know, colored pictures. And so they were an immediate hit. I think the two men with their different sensitivities, their young children, and their talents just came together in a wonderful collaboration.
When you consider what was accomplished with the books, and then when you read them carefully, and when you look at your book and what you are exploring in this natural world, so the bush the thorny bush that Pooh gets pricked by, these gorse bushes, you see those are very much there in that forest, and even that iconic map that you mentioned is pretty close.
Yeah, the gorse is still there. The landscape is covered in yellow most of the year. There are two different kinds of gorse. There's a dwarf gorse and a European gorse. So there's a smaller one and a much larger one, they just carpet the landscape. And in August and September, the heath come out, and so you have this beautiful tapestry of gold and purple together, punctuated by solitary Scots pines that have sort of a gray-green hue to them, and beautiful sort of gangly wild structure to them. And on top of Galleon's Lap, where you've walked, there's white sand, beautiful open skies. You can practically throw a stone to France. It feels so close. It's wild open, and you really feel the wind blowing through the trees that E.H. Shepherd drew. There's a lovely picture of Pooh and Piglet walking through a landscape and holding hands, and you can see their heads are down and they're trying to get through the wind. And I've experienced all that, so I spent a lot of time, lots and lots of research went into the book. There's a lot of research behind the scenes there. But also I knew when to chuck the books for the boots and just went out for walks to give people a real sensorial kind of experience of what it felt like to be in the Hundred Acre Wood, to touch the gorse, to smell different flowers, to come across sundews that Charles Darwin was fascinated by. And then, of course, I hung out in the Hatch Inn, which was established in 1430, and that's where Ezra Pound and W.B. Yeats kind of develop modernism in a way. So there are a couple sidebars in the book where I talk about that. But I definitely am. It's a first-person narrative. I'm in there every now and then. I want people to experience the magic themselves. So I sort of duck out at times and describe and go into some research details. But otherwise, I'm a field guide. It's sort of a genial, approachable field guide for people who are familiar with the stories.
Did you cry?
Oh, I always cry. Yes. Well, the backstory is that as I was writing about The Enchanted Place, and that's for people who don't know, that is the place where Christopher Robin says goodbye to his stuffed animals. And
right.
We know what's happening. He's going off to boarding school.
Right.
But the animals don't know. But why is Christopher Robin leaving? And so my own children were going off to boarding school. Two of them, I have three children, and two of them now go to boarding school in Exeter, New Hampshire, even though I live in the original Exeter, England. And so they were leaving, and it's very emotional that just being in the Hundred Acres, even being in the Enchanted Place, because it's a cluster of trees, and you're in it, and you feel like you're in a cave or a nest, or the arms of your mother. It's very intimate, the sunlight comes through, so this dappled light through the pine trees, and you can feel and hear the wind in the tops of the trees. But if you're inside, you can also look out at this incredible landscape. It's because the Enchanted Place is at the top of the forest. So there was a lot of crying that went. Also tears of joy because it's so sweet.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And of course, a lot of that is memory. It's so sensory. And it is. But it also is that you can't believe you're in this place that you have sort of dreamed about. It's also one of those rare occasions where what you have imagined in perhaps in a fictional landscape that actually matches it.
It is. It's really it's almost surreal. So if you know the stories well, you've had grandparents read them to your parents. It's surreal and rare at the same time that it's still there, it's still protected, and you can walk through it. It does feel like walking through the pages of the stories.
One of the things that you really point out in the book, and you make this case, is that what Christopher Robin had was an opportunity to travel all around this 6,000 acre forest and explore. And many of our kids don't have that opportunity. And what a special thing that is to get out in nature and to be Christopher Robin and to live in that imaginary world for a little bit.
It's true. I think that I don't know if A.A. Milne would really recognize modern childhood. I would say that one thing that hit me, it was like a wave of nostalgia and a wave of yearning for childhoods of the past when I was writing the book, was, you know, people came up to me and in conversations in pubs and, you know, everywhere, people would say, well, my grandchildren can't walk more than, you know, 100 yards from their front door. Once I realized what kind of childhood Milne himself had and wanted to give and gave to Christopher Robin, I think the stories can be read as a field guide for the free-range child. And it might be a way for timid parents. And I don't think the problems are really in children. Children want to explore. They're really innately curious. I think maybe parents could read the original Winnie the Pooh stories, pick up my book, and see that it's a real landscape and say, well, you know what? Let's go out on our own expedition today and discover a North Pole. Or, you know, bring the animals along. Let's go out. So it is it's really important for children to have imaginative play away from the watchful eyes of parents. I mean, obviously, we need to be observant for safety reasons, but I think doing nothing is a really important something for children.
So there is not one controversial thing in this book. So let me just ask the controversial question, which is, and I've long felt this way, and I'm just curious, since you live in England, but you're an American, of how you feel the original toys, the Winnie the Pooh and Piglet and others, are being conserved right now. They're off out of being conserved and not on display at the New York Public Library, where they have been since the 1950s. There have been efforts, the most recent one in the late 90s, to bring those toys back to England. Do you believe they should be in England?
That's a good question. I haven't been asked that before. I was joking to friends because I'm speaking at the New York Public Library that I joke, well, I should just abscond with them. No one will notice and I'll take them back. they are beloved all around the world. That is for sure. And the reason they got there is that they went through, A.A. Milne gave them to his publisher and the publisher moved them to some offices in New York and they just never came back. I do believe that they probably should be back in England. I think they're part of English heritage. I think, and I say that because Pustick's Bridge has been rebuilt many times. And the last project was entirely, there was some controversy there about having maybe Disney fund it. And I do want to say something about Disney, which is I don't think that A.A. Milne would have minded what happened to his characters because he was an early screenwriter. And I think he would not have minded. I'm a bit of a purist. I would have minded, but I don't think we're talking about Milne. Yeah. He would not probably have minded. But anyway, Pustick's Bridge has been rebuilt a few times. And the latest bridge, people said, no, we want, this is part of our English heritage. We want it to be built of English oak by English people. You know, English, it's completely English, in other words. So I am a bit of a purist. I think that the characters should belong back in London.
And one of the things that you notice, and I don't know that we're as good at this in our country, but in England, where the houses are so beautifully marked as to where A.A. Milne lived. Preserving that literary history.
Yeah, with blue plaques, they're very good at preserving their history. I mean, we've done a great job here in as Americans handling these characters because look at them; they're in great condition. Of course, they're being they're getting a little cleaning up right now, but they've been very, very well taken care of. So, yeah, some people might disagree with me, but I don't know. I'm just a bit of a purist and. But I also acknowledge how they're beloved around the world. So,
well, the name of the book is The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-Acre Wood. The book is published by Timber Press. Catherine Alto, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you much for sharing this with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Great pleasure. Again, Catherine Alto's book is The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh. It is published by Timber Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.